United States submarine base at Key West, Florida. A dispatch that quoted President Truman's press secretary, Charles Ross, as saying that President Truman has no knowledge of any secret project by this government that would give substance to the existence of such objects. Ross also said that both the Air Force
and
the
Navy
deny that such objects exist.
What was that? I said, wait, let me open up my candy real quick. And then you...
What candy is that?
You know, Noelle, it's ginger chews. It's a really good candy if you get acid reflux in your old age.
Is this like when you tried to give me candy, but it was just a cough drop?
It was menthol honey drops. But it was like honey that eaten menthol.
Yeah, it was... a cough drop. But anyway.
It tasted like cough drop. But what you were tasting was
you're like,
the
do you
menthol.
Want a piece of candy? And I was like, yeah. And then it was a literal cough drop. Okay.
It was honey and the bees had eaten menthol. So it was menthol infused honey into a droplet. If you want to say that that's a cough drop, you could make that argument. But I bought it from a candy tent at the state fair.
Well,
so...
they're selling lies, fairy tales, and fallacies because that was medicine. That was medicinal. That had nothing to do with fucking candy. Anyway. Hey, what's up? My name's Noelle, and I actually think I'm going to go to Mexico and get my teeth fixed.
Oh, you should. It's cheaper.
Yeah, like, in a big way.
Because how much would it be to get significant teeth work done? Like 30 grand?
Oh, well, like, here? So for what I want to do, it's going to cost upwards of like $2,500, $3,000 tops. And in Mexico, I could get all of it done, plus like whitening, and honestly, probably fix my fucking bottom jaw, my little crooked guy. This is what happens when you don't wear a retainer. It just goes 180. And I bet it would be, I bet I could get the flight, hotel, and pay for all of it for under, way under the amount that my dentist is quoting me. Even for just the bare minimum, even just getting like fillings, I think I have like four cavities I need filled. Chump change in Mexico. Chump change.
Yeah.
Whereas like here, even with full dental insurance, you know, I'm still looking at a few hundred dollars.
I saw a thing where it was like a girl was like, enjoy a beauty day in Mexico with me. She got like a manicure, pedicure, got full set of highlights. She went and got like a facial. She went and got a massage. And she was like, I spent $112 today.
Yep.
I was like, oh, okay.
Yep. Yeah. No, literally. It's like when I had to get my, what is that called? Well, I'm blanking on it now. When they, root canal.
Wisdom teeth? Oh, root canal. Yeah.
When I had to get my root canal done, they brought out a form for me to sign to apply for a loan from the bank to get my fucking root canal done. And I was like,
so ridiculous.
This is so dystopian. This is so fucking dystopian. But that's because I didn't have $1,200 just sitting in my goddamn pocket. So they're like, they literally like, well, we have this form with Mountain America. I was like, get fucking for real.
Yeah. Or they're like, oh, we use Care Credit. And I'm like, I don't want, like, I do have Care Credit.
Yeah, I have Care Credit, but that's with the dogs.
I'm like, why can't I just like do a payment plan here with you?
Mm-hmm.
Why can't we just do that? And they're like, no.
Yeah. Yeah.
Money up front.
Yeah. I'll pay you guys $50 till the day I die. But like, come on. Like, what? Make me a deal here.
Yeah. It's pretty ridiculous. What you got to do is just not pay it. And then when collections comes, have like a little chunk of change, be like, I'll give you $200 right now if you make this go away. And they're like, yeah, we'll forgive your other $2,300 worth of debt because isn't real.
I wish that's how it was. I've had my wages garnished twice. Off of bills that were less than like $500. And it was just because I didn't even know. And then by the time I found out they were already garnishing it, it was too late. And I was like, oh, well, I guess I'll go fuck myself. So, yeah, I used to think that if you just ignored it, it would go away, but it doesn't. And it won't.
No, they find
and
you
they'll,
now.
They'll find you. They'll find you. And if you think it's a small amount, oh, baby, are you wrong? No amount is too small for these fucking predators, for these fucking vultures. But anyway, who are you?
I'm Chelsea, and with enough science, I could become made of gold.
That's true.
I could.
You know, when I was going over the notes, at first I was like, this is cuckoo bananas. And then I was like, actually, I get where they're coming from. Like, I get why they thought this. So anyway, tell us what we're going over today.
I'm actually super jazzed because I knew that you would be an expert on some of this stuff when we get into the thick of it. And I was like, fuck, dude, I'm going to have to lean so hard on Noel and seeing you like, came through clutch. My girl came through.
I mean, I didn't want to go too much into, there's a point where it could have gone really in the weeds and I didn't want to. So I just redirect people to go into the weeds themselves.
Yeah.
We'll get there when we get there.
So once again, we are talking about an episode that was inspired by the AMVs that I used to watch. One of them being Full Metal Alchemist.
Mm-hmm.
We are talking about alchemy, an ancient art form shrouded in mystery and magic. Also,
I think it's more real than people give it credit for. But anyway,
it is definitely real. We believe in everything. If I get too spitty, if I get too saliva-esque, it's because I have this candy in my mouth. Tell me and I'll just spit
it out. My fucking God.
I am salivating right now and I just feel like I'm talking like pure spit.
Spit it out. God.
You can tell though? Can you tell?
I'm going to now.
All right, hold on. Let me spit it out.
Oh my fucking God. This is crazy. It's like
a gummy, so I gotta roll it up.
You can't chew candy or gum when you're recording.
I'm gonna put it under my tongue, but it's fucking ginger, so it's spicy.
You're out here acting like it's fucking chew, and you got a spit cup. You're crazy for that. That was crazy.
I'll eat it later.
Anyway, it's just gonna get all hard and nasty.
But long before the dawn of modern science, alchemists embark on a quest for the extraordinary, turning their laboratories into sanctuaries of transformation. With a blend of ancient recipes and mythical substances, such as the Philosopher's Stone, these pioneering spirits sought to unlock the secrets of creation itself.
So, for me, understanding alchemy is one thing. I completely forgot, or at least erased from my memory, that the Philosopher's Stone wasn't just the first Harry Potter book, but it was a byproduct and the main focus of like alchemy. And I had heard like two different things about the Philosopher's Stone. I first heard that its purpose was to turn any metal, like any metal substance, into gold. And then the second was that it makes you immortal. But I guess the answer is that it actually does both.
Yeah, I was very confused because I think my first introduction was also Harry Potter.
Mm-hmm.
And then going through this, I was like, I don't think I know what it is, actually.
Yeah, it does both. So, like, that's its whole purpose. It's just a magic stone that apparently does the two main things in alchemy, which is turn anything to gold and make you immortal.
Mm-hmm. So, imagine the allure of being able to craft gold, silver, and sparkling gems from ordinary materials, or to concoct a vibrant purple dye that rivals the hues of sunset, all through the mastery of alchemy. And this wasn't just about wealth or beauty. It was a profound exploration of the boundaries between the material and the mystical. Alchemists believed that with the right combination of elements and the application of arcane processes, they could replicate all the treasures of the earth. But their ambitions didn't stop at mere material gains. As centuries passed, the alchemical quest evolved, delving deeper into the realms of the spiritual and the medicinal. Alchemists turned their attention to the creation of potent elixirs, potions designed not only to heal the body but to extend life itself, which offered a glimpse into the possibility of immortality. The pursuit of such an elixir wasn't just about defying age. It was a journey towards enlightenment and a way to touch the divine. Even more profound was the alchemist's quest for the redemption of the soul. This spiritual journey represented the ultimate transformation, one that sought to purify and elevate the human spirit to its higher potential. Through their experiments, meditations, and rituals, alchemists explored the inner workings of the soul, seeking to reconcile the physical with the spiritual, to harmonize the earthly with the heavenly.
I also think it's good to point out that alchemy wasn't just a bunch of magical, mystical gumbo. It was also what formed the base of chemistry. They basically share the same definition. Chemistry is a science that deals with the composition, structure, and properties of substances, and with the transformations they undergo. And alchemy is trying to understand why substances are the way they are so they can ultimately force the transformation, aka turn everything into gold. And we basically do a modern form of alchemy with man-made diamonds.
Yeah, it's one of those things that we've talked about before where the way that you phrase something makes it sound more mythical until it gets accepted into modern science. It's like, oh, when a cryptid becomes like an actual creature, like the gorilla or like the, I don't know, like any other animal that used to be like a shark. You know, what are other animals that used to be cryptids and then they turned out to be real?
Megalodons. Narwhals.
Yeah, squids. Narwhals.
I think we are too modern brained when we hear the word alchemy and we go like, oh, you know, spooky, scary. When you have to like put your mindset into a person of that time, you didn't just wake up one day and go like, I'm going to understand science and I'm going to create medicines that will cure diseases. Like you didn't wake up with that thought. You got there eventually. It's like you didn't wake up and think about a light bulb. You figured out electricity first, you know? And alchemy was that first step. People were fucking banging two rocks together, hoping to get rich, which was technically alchemy. They were trying to figure out how to make magic real so that they could live better lives. It was hocus pocus. And in doing that, they actually discovered science. Like a lot of big advances and the foundations of chemistry as a whole came from alchemists who were doing alchemy in their quote unquote spare time and then formed essentially what is modern chemistry.
Yeah, absolutely. Because if you think about the three main questions of alchemy, it doesn't sound like anything that a modern day accepted scientist would ask themselves. It's how do things come into existence? What are they made of? And can we transform these things into something else entirely?
Mm-hmm.
And I think all of those things we have definitive answers for in pretty much everything, like down to the atom. We know how things are made. We know what they're made of. And we know through chemical processes how to make those changes.
Yeah.
And this is all alchemy is.
I mean, I even think that still to this day, the hardest thing for me to wrap my mind around is gasoline, right? How did we essentially get dinosaur bones fueling our fucking cars and like other shit? Mm-hmm. But like, how did we get there? My brain has the hardest time understanding why that's the only solution to the equation and how we got to that point. And in the simplest terms, it was alchemy.
Yeah. Also Fred Flintstone figured it out.
Also Fred Flintstone for sure.
But definitely, and alchemists around the globe have been pretty united that all of these are questions that they could answer a definitive yes to, especially since unlocking these mysteries really lay in deciphering the first two queries, setting them on a quest to discover the recipes and apparatus needed to create substances like gold. So alchemy's central premise revolved around the notion of purification and transformation. Alchemists were convinced that they could refine substances, stripping them of impurities to forge something new, or combine different materials to produce a substance with completely new attributes. They observed that nature was constantly at work, transforming materials in a myriad of ways, and thus their ultimate goal became to just mimic and even accelerate these natural processes through the use of a catalyst. And this legendary catalyst, the Philosopher's Stone, was thought to hold the key to not only converting base metals into gold, but also unlocking the secret to eternal life. Alchemy flourished in Greco-Roman Egypt between the 1st and 7th centuries CE. And it was a tradition that was actually carried forward by the Byzantine Empire into the Arab world. And this period marked a vibrant exchange of ideas across cultures with the concept of an elixir for life.
Also, did you get a new charm bracelet or something?
No. Is it hitting?
That's so weird. I heard like, it almost sounded like...
That?
Nope. It sounded like a wind chime, so I thought it was maybe a charm bracelet hitting.
I spilled some tea earlier, and I wiped it up with my sock, and
not
Puffin's licking the floor right now. Maybe that's what you're hearing.
Not that. It was like legit a wind chime, or I would assume maybe charms hitting each other. Spooky, anyway.
No, it's just...
definitely not the dog licking the fucking tea, but good
try.
Buddy.
He never comes in here to say hi.
It's because he heard my voice. Bear.
It did. Did you hear Noelle? Do you miss her? He said no.
Well, that's you. I know that was you.
I know he's hungry. He's like, buh. Hold on. I know. Oh, well, nope. I tried to pick him up and he ran away.
That's what you got.
Too close to the sun. I am Icarus. So, back to licking the floor.
Anyway. Oh, fuck. Chinese alchemy was tied into ideas about the earth itself. In Chinese natural philosophy, they see the earth as one living organism. And basically using that earth magic and power is incorporated into what we now know as feng shui. Its goal is to harmonize you with the environment to promote well-being, balance, and positive energy. And that's all came from alchemy. A Chinese alchemist also accidentally discovered gunpowder. In the process of mixing various substances in the search for the elixir of immortality, when they combined saltpeter, charcoal, and sulfur in specific portions, the resulting mixture obviously exploded and is now what we know as gunpowder. Indian alchemy focused on medicine with the overall goal of creating an undecaying body. Unfortunately, using lots of mercury, so I understand where maybe stereotypes of a crazy alchemist come into play. Mm-hmm. They also developed aphrodisiacs and poisons, which are both cool for different reasons. Hold on, let me give Oliver a middle finger. There we go. They're both cool for different reasons. And unfortunate when you think about how they figured out the differences in them. If, you know, the way we figured out gunpowder was by exploding shit, how did you decipher what was an aphrodisiac, making your dick hard, and what killed someone? Anyway, the blend of both and philosophical alchemy is what made its way to Islamic alchemy. So a mix of basically everything. It's funny that the whole point of alchemy is transformation, and each version of it transformed depending on the culture that touched it.
Yeah, with like earth magic versus physical magic, and then we get gunpowder and aphrodisiacs and poison.
Yep.
That's fun. So in like moving on from like it being introduced in Chinese world, being brought over by the Arabs, it then kind of moved over into Hellenistic Egypt around the 3rd century AD, when the legendary figure of Hermes Trismegistus, man, I fucking missed a pronunciation.
Job. Yeah, I'm surprised you didn't spell that out.
Trismegistus, I missed it. Otherwise known as the thrice great Hermes. So imagine a figure so shrouded in mystery that he becomes the embodiment of the wisdom of alchemy itself. The Emerald Tablet, attributed to him with its cryptic message, as above, so below, became the cornerstone of alchemical philosophy, inspiring countless seekers to ponder the mysteries of the cosmos and the soul. And among the luminaries of ancient philosophy, Democritus, a 5th century BCE philosopher and explorer, emerges as a significant figure in the frequently referenced and was frequently referenced in discussions of alchemy. His groundbreaking ideas, such as atomic theory, suggested that the universe is made up of tiny, indivisible particles, atomos, having a different substance characterized by a unique arrangement of these particles. Basically, he figured out atoms and molecules.
Mm-hmm.
And the concept forms the bedrock of alchemy's ultimate ambition, which was transmuting common substances into previous ones, such as turning lead into gold or, you know, just by rearranging their atomic structure. And this vision of transformation grounded in the manipulation was the very building blocks of nature, presented a challenge that has basically fascinated alchemists throughout history. So fast forward to the 8th century, and we're in the heart of the Islamic Golden Age. Here we meet Jabir ibn Hayyan, also called Geber of the West, a polymath whose works laid in the foundations for later alchemical practices. So picture this. He's a man whose writings on alchemy, such as the Book of the Composition of Alchemy, influenced not just the Islamic world, but also medieval Europe. Jabir's quest for the elixir of life and his work on the Philosopher's Stone captivated the images of scholars for centuries. It's become part of our cultural zeitgeist. And now let's leap into the Middle Ages in Europe, where alchemy flourished in the shadowy corners of monasteries and castles. Enter Albertus Magnus, a 13th century German Dominican friar and bishop, rumored to have discovered the Philosopher's Stone. Now, whether this was myth or reality, Albertus's contribution to alchemy, notably in the works De Alchimia, showcase the era's deep entanglement with the mystical and the material.
Thinking about medieval alchemists feels all cloak and dagger, but I would like to point out, much like people who wear cloaks today, it was way more nerdy than cool. They're obsessed with the concept of palingenesis or rebirth. You may have heard it in Lovecraft's The Case of Charles Dexter Ward, since that whole story is essentially about a quest to understand alchemy. My brain automatically goes to Frankenstein with this, since that is technically a form of palingenesis, as it involves the scientific reanimation of dead matter rather than the magical or occult practices associated with something like necromancy.
Mm-hmm.
But in actuality, medieval alchemists were just burning, dissolving, and then freezing things like leaves.
Yeah.
And trees and sticks. And then hoping
put them in water and drink it.
Yep. Hoping to transmutate something into something else.
I always want something to be so much more punk rock than it is, but it would be cool to do like a whole episode on the Philosopher's Stone. That's not how this started. So mm-hmm. It's not how it will end, but it would be really cool, like mythical artifacts of history.
Yeah, it's because there's so many instances of people saying they figured it out. And on paper, it's not as sci-fi as it seems in theory, right? Because it is mm-hmm. just rearranging atoms and molecules. Like, we do it. We do forms of alchemy. When you create enough pressure on coal, you know, like it becomes a diamond, whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, enough pressure in sand becomes a pearl. You know, I'm not a scientist, but these are the assumptions, the overarching yeah. themes. And that's technically all alchemy. It's taking one thing and turning it into something else. And changing its physical properties, right?
Yeah.
And liquid to solid, solid to liquid, vice versa.
Yeah, and no real discussion of alchemy is complete without mentioning Nicolas Flamel, who is a 14th century French scribe who allegedly achieved the alchemical magnus opus. Legend has it that Flamel, through a mysterious book, decoded the secrets of transmutation, turning base metals into gold. And the story of his quest, detailed in the texts like the Book of Abraham the Jew, continues to fuel the legend of the immortal alchemist. But it was really during the Renaissance and the Scientific Revolution, which was a period marked by rekindled interest in the ancient alchemist's work, that alchemy underwent a significant transformation. It was an influx of Islamic alchemy texts into the Western world via translations that started this resurgence, which breathed new life into the exploration of the material and mystical worlds. Hellscape is a supernatural roller derby comic book series dripping of blood, demons, and glitter. Saya is a fresh meat skater with a dangerous crush on her favorite derby player. Desperate to be accepted, she attempts to cast a magic spell in hopes of winning her idol's admiration, but instead unleashes a demonic possession that seeks to destroy her and her team at that night's Halloween game. The first issue is out now. Visit hellscape.com to get your limited edition copy today. So let's get into the tapestry of Renaissance Europe and specifically focus on two figures who really stand out for their deep dive into the mystical and alchemical arts. We have John Dee and Edward Kelly. And their story is a blend of magic, science, and ambition, all set against the backdrop of a continent teeming with intellectual curiosity and religious upheaval. Edward Kelly's journey began under rather ignominious circumstances. Around mid-16th century, this English lawyer, known for his distinctive cap designed to hide the scars of a punishment for forgery, stumbled across a curious find in a Welsh inn. An old manuscript, rumored to have been plundered from the grave of a wealthy Catholic bishop during religious wars, caught his eye. Accompanied by two ivory balls, one discarded for containing nothing but powder, and the other was a mystery waiting to be unveiled. This manuscript was about to change Kelly's fate. Sensing its potential, Kelly acquired it, stole it, and along with the remaining white ball, for mere guinea. Now enter Dr. John Dee, a man of vast intellect and curiosity, serving as a consultant to Queen Elizabeth I. Dee, already steeped in the study of hermetic science, recognized the manuscript's allusions to the Philosopher's Stone and the arcane process of transmutation. When Kelly showed him the white ball, which housed a projection powder capable of turning metal into gold, Both men were astounded by the successful demonstration of alchemy at work. And bound by their quest for knowledge and gold, Dee and Kelly embarked on a journey across Bohemia and Germany. And despite Dee's inability to fully decipher the bishop's manuscript, they leveraged the power to maintain an extravagant lifestyle, drawing the attention of Emperor Maximilian II. And Kelly's claims of alchemical prowess earned him the title of Marshal of Bohemia. But also the emperor's insistence on uncovering the secret of the projection powder's creation. This demand led to Kelly's imprisonment, and unable to divulge a secret he did not possess, while Dee, sensing the tide turning, sought refuge back in England under the Queen's protection. And throughout their partnership, Dee and Kelly essentially created what we now know as Enochian magic.
Enochian?
Potato, potato.
Well, maybe not. I'll tell you in a second. But
yeah, no, I'm Enochian sure you're right.
Magic is said to be given to you by communicating through angels. Even the term Enochian is derived from the biblical figure Enoch, who is said to have walked with God. They created their own Enochian alphabet and language. With this, they performed rituals, invocations, and using magical tools that created their ability to communicate with angels, gain esoteric knowledge, and achieve spiritual insight. And even the language and alphabet they said was like given to them by angels, very Joseph Smith and the gold tablets of them. Mm-hmm. One pop culture example of these rituals would be the opening of the watchtowers, which is a ritual designed to invoke the presence and power of the Enochian angels associated with the four watchtowers, which correspond to the four cardinal directions, north, south, east, and west. You may remember this from a scene in The Craft. And there, there you go. They were practicing Enochian magic. The Enochian magical system is one of the few, quote, magical practices that is genuinely believed and revered by different religions.
I think this is also in Supernatural. I think it's like the sigils that they draw to do certain shit with the angels. It's super cool.
Yeah,
I don't think it's probably not the same. But the Book of Enoch, interestingly enough, is one of the banned books of the Bible.
Really?
Yeah, that's
We've got to get into the fucking banned books of the Bible, dude.
I have two copies of from the Ashes of Angels, where they talk about the Book of Enoch, but also specifically like giants and like banned books. I'll whip it out and we can do a deep dive on it, because this is where you also get the idea that Noah was probably albino, because it talks about him. Yeah, it talks about him being born with like skin so bright, like you could stare at it, and also like eyes like fire. You're like, oh.
Albino.
And also like the Nephilim being born. Because angels came down and like had sex with human women, and it talks about all of that.
Damn, the cool stuff. I also really like all of the like Genesis. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
The evil shit. Like, we've talked about it before, where like the New Testament was the PR campaign for God, like to make him seem not so evil and jealous and fucking awful. But the cool stories come from him being fucking evil.
There's so crazy stuff. It would be cool to do maybe like an Old versus New Testament episode breakdown, but I know neither you and I are experts.
I know.
It would be like
the blind leading the blind.
It would be like the LaCroix of the fucking Bible, where it's like the Bible was in the room when we wrote the episode, but you're not. The flavor is a mere whisper, a mere suggestion, really.
Dude, I have tried so hard to like really sit down and read the Bible, and it reminds me of being in middle school and reading like a history book, because I'll go through the same page like four times. And I either don't read it, and then I'm like, damn, I didn't actually obtain any of that. Or it makes no fucking sense. And I'm like, huh?
Yeah, it's the Bible's a rough read. I haven't read the whole thing, but I've read the chunks that I want to.
Well, you know what some would call that.
Well, but I will say, though, that like going to church for probably like 20 years every Sunday, I probably learned end to end the Bible in some way, but you think this smooth brain retained it?
Here's the tea. I think we've got to come with questions about the Old Testament, and we've got to meet with a priest who's willing to be recorded.
I can ask. Oh, recorded. I don't know. I don't know if my pastor, my old pastor.
No, we don't want. No, we don't want to do that. We need to go to like a Catholic priest.
I just think he's going to be the most educated person that we could find because he has like a essentially a doctorate in theology.
But I don't want him to be on the receiving end of our questions. I also want someone who's willing to be recorded.
Yeah, he might. I don't know. Well, if we have like any questions, I can always DM them to him and let him know what we're doing. And I'm sure he'd answer. We still have like a great relationship. We both have the same agreements about organized religion. He also thinks it's a sham. So
love that. But yeah. I want anyway. To see how someone defends the Old Testament. But yeah, first, we've got to read it.
So anyway, in my opinion, people who defend the Old Testament are ignorant, or just ignorant people who are like, you can't be gay. It's like all of that law of Moses bullshit went out the window.
But that's what they like. Jesus. But that's the fun part of the conversation and discussion is that they cherry pick parts of the Old Testament to justify racism and bigotry and homophobia. But then when you try to bring the other shit of the Old Testament, that's fucking the brutal, you know, murders and jealousy and evilness, essentially, they are like, oh, but that, not that part, but not that part. And it's like, let's call a spade, bitch. So, I definitely would have to be more well-versed in my Old Testament lore, but you know, we'll get there.
Yeah. I don't know. It's always so interesting too. And we're getting off on the religious thing, especially with like the new trans argument. It's always so weird to hear like people's argument with that stuff. Because there's plenty of things in the Bible in the New Testament that say that kind of stuff is fine. If you want to use like the same lens of deciphering the Bible as you do for the Old Testament. It's like Galatians say that there's like no man nor woman, like Greek or Jew. Oh, what is it? I wonder if I should Google it. But anyway, it's like there's no such thing as man or woman, Greek or Jew, like because everyone's one in like Christ. But it's like, oh, that's interesting. That seems to be one of the definitive things that it talks about gender in the Bible. And it says that it doesn't necessarily matter. Mm-hmm. Interesting. But now you're letting little trans kids get beat to death at school because you need to back up your bigotry because you can't say it with your fucking chest because you're a coward.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the tea of it all. And I feel like no one's really like pinned down the conversation of fighting like biblical reasoning with biblical reasoning. Like, I don't think anyone's actually having that conversation because, first of all, the type of people who are on the front lines are not religious.
Yeah.
And or are not as well versed in religion. And so, like, that's just like a missing piece. It's the whole, like, learn your enemy and fight the way they do.
Should make merch. Like, we should make merch that's like, I learned how to have an abortion from the Bible because the Bible talks about drinking bitter roots to, like, end a pregnancy. And so we should do that. Like, thank God for teaching me how to have an abortion. You know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
That'd be so fucking punk rock.
And then like, put the Bible verse on the back or something.
Yeah,
that would be sick.
That'd be so cool. And then like the Galatians ones, but there's like going to be a million more that we can pull up where we can like turn it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh my God. Bam! Oliver.
Anyway,
there's there's 50 toys, but they both want the same one.
Yeah. Oh, dude,
now he's going to run and hide. Anyway, Kelly, while in prison, came to a profound realization about alchemy. It was not just about the material wealth, but also about healing and ultimately the spiritual transformation of the soul. He understood that alchemy in its truest form was about the pursuit of perfection, mirroring the natural evolution of elements towards gold and the soul's journey towards divine unity. John Dee, on the other hand, returned to England to find his once great library in ruins. And despite the setback, his contributions to mathematics, astronomy, and navigation remained unparalleled. His angelic communications and hermetic pursuits painted him as the quintessential magician, a figure that would inspire countless tales and characters in literature. And Edward Kelly's life came to a tragic end as he died attempting to escape from prison. And despite the controversies and mysteries that surrounded them, Dean Kelly's foray into alchemy and the occult left an indelible mark on the intellectual landscape of the Renaissance. Their quest for knowledge, though fraught with danger and misunderstanding, highlights a period where the boundaries between science, magic, and spirituality were fluid, and the thirst for understanding knew no bounds. And while John Dee and Edward Kelly may not be historical names that you know, let's talk about someone everyone will know. So enter Aleister Crowley. We should get that. If we could have licensing to like, Mr. Crowley.
Yeah. I think we weren't too lazy. 30 seconds, and that's how you get away with not getting a copyright strike.
Maybe. But also, do you and I have the opposite of laziness?
No.
Yeah, yep, that's what I thought.
Not happening.
So born Edward Alexander Crowley on October 12th, 1875, in Royal Leamington Spa, England, Crowley was an influential and controversial figure in the early 20th century's esoteric and occult movements. Crowley's early life, marked by a strict Plymouth Brethren upbringing, deviated dramatically as he pursued an interest in Western esotericism, ultimately leading to his lifelong engagement with various mystical and magical traditions. His education at Cambridge University did not lead to a degree, but instead to the discovery of his true passion for the occult. And Crowley's journey into the occult began in earnest with his initiation into the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn.
The Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, sometimes and simply called the Golden Dawn, was a secret society and occult organization from the late 19th century. It was founded in London in 1888 by the guys Chelsea's going to name below. I'm not going to even attempt to do that. The Golden Dawn was heavily influenced by Western esotericism, Hermeticism, which we all know is the teachings of the Greek gods Hermes and I even tried to write it out and it didn't help me at all.
You added the W in there, which is throwing me off. It looks like Hoth, but with a T in front of it.
Yeah, but I think that's how it's supposed to be pronounced. Anyway.
Thouth.
Kabbalah, which is an esoteric tradition within Judaism, and ceremonial magic. The Golden Dawn practiced various occult disciplines, including divination, alchemy, astrology, and ritual magic. It was broken out into different grades, each with its own teaching and rituals. Members graduated through these grades as they gained knowledge and experience.
Do you remember when Kabbalah went
viral
really
with Madonna?
Viral?
Yeah, like everyone was wearing. Early 2000s, yeah.
You know, I also Googled Thoth, how you would write it or like pronounce it.
It has a W.
Phonetically.
Yeah.
And I found Thoth. T-O-H-T.
We'll never know. We'll never fucking know.
It's interesting. So anyway, Crowley studied under the founders William Wynne Westcott, Samuel Liddell McGregor Mathers, and William Robert Woodman. However, his abrasive personality and disagreements with other members led to his departure. This did not deter him. Instead, Crowley continued to explore and expand upon his esoteric knowledge, traveling extensively and studying various religious and magical systems. In 1904, while in Cairo, Egypt, Crowley, is it Cairo?
It's Cairo. It's Cairo.
You know, I've been watching Welcome to Plathville and I live in Cairo. Fucking okay. The South, but not Cairo, Egypt. It doesn't.
It's okay.
Crowley claimed to have received the Book of the Law from a discarnate entity named Iwas.
And I just want to point out the trip to Egypt, because this is also where Crowley, he's the power bottom. He notoriously power bottomed Victor Nuremberg into insanity in the name of sex magic. Specifically, there were like sex magic rituals that required homosexuality in the desert, and he was like, what a perfect time. For more information, I advise you to listen to last podcast on the left's Crowley series, or Google, quote, an excerpt from the Place of an Enchantment, British Occultism and the Culture of the Modern by Alex Owen, specifically chapter 6, which is titled Aleister Crowley in the Desert. And this goes into the whole like Victor Nuremberg meeting Crowley right out of college, and basically going insane from hanging out with him. And I just love the dichotomy of Crowley being the power bottom and literally being like, fuck me to the point of insanity for the name of enlightenment. That's pretty awful, also, but pretty cool.
The chaos magic of like charging sigils with sex is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the sex magic and chaos magic is where the magic with the CK comes from. And it's all like Aleister Crowley was like, I'm figuring this out. Mm-hmm. And some people argue that you get results when you practice it. So who's to say?
The only people I know who really dove deep into it are Marcus Parks and Henry Zabarowski. And then they were like, don't recommend it. We went mm-hmm. off the deep end. So yep. it seems,
scary.
Intense. Yeah. It's almost like the Sarlacc pit. Like you get caught and you are just being sucked into the digestion of chaos.
Mm-hmm.
And very few get out. And if you get out, they just write a really terrible, short series about you where all of a sudden you're a good guy and it's stupid.
From chaos magic, you get tulpas.
Yeah. I want to make a tulpa for the podcast.
I don't think you do, dog. This is what we're just talking about.
But now I know I don't want to do it. Noelle, Chelsea doesn't want to do it. Podcast Chelsea wants content.
We have so many tulpas from the internet that have manifested into reality. We don't need to do more. There's so much proof of it just manifesting into existence. Like, but yeah, it's a form of chaos magic.
So with the chaos magic and Crowley's like adventures into Egypt also comes the Book of Law, which became the foundation of Thelema, which was a new religious movement with the central tenet being do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. And Crowley dedicated the rest of his life to establishing Thelema and integrating its principles into his magical work. And Crowley's interest in alchemy was both literal and symbolic. He saw alchemical processes as metaphors for spiritual transformation, a theme central to Thelema and his broader magical philosophy. And Crowley's alchemical work aimed at the transmutation of the self, seeking to achieve spiritual enlightenment and a higher state of consciousness. He incorporated alchemical symbolism into Thelemic rituals, seeing the great work of alchemy not just as the pursuit of turning base metals into gold, but rather as a spiritual path leading to the discovery of one's true will and the attainment of divine union. Crowley's writings on alchemy, including his interpretations of alchemical texts and the integration of alchemical concepts into magical practices, were prolific. He viewed the magnum opus of alchemy as parallel to the journey of the magician seeking to unify the microcosm with the microcosm. Through rituals, symbols, and meditations steeped in alchemical lore, Crowley sought to harness the transformative power of alchemy to achieve both personal growth and to further the aims of Thelema, his religion. But despite the controversies surrounding his life and work, Crowley's influence on both esoteric traditions and popular culture is undeniable. His deep engagement with alchemy enriched his magical theory and practice, contributing significantly to his legacy as a seminal figure in modern occultism. Through his synthesis of alchemical wisdom with ceremonial magic, Crowley offered a path to transformation that continues to inspire seekers of esoteric knowledge.
Also, do people know what esoteric is? I guess we should give a definition. I feel like it's always thrown around. Like being esoteric or a state of esotericism is intended for or likely to be understood by only a small number of people with a specialized knowledge or interest. Yeah, so you can be esoteric philosopher. You could be an esoteric philosophical debater. You don't just have to be like esoteric magic. It's just like learning like a small group of people specializing in knowledge that is like unknown to the mass majority or restricted.
Yeah, it's like insider information in certain topics like magic or mysticism that isn't meant for everyone. It's like basically like a Knight's Templar. It's a mm-hmm. secret only known by a few people. mm-hmm. either have the knowledge or the interest in it.
Yeah, some would even say that like the handshakes that Mormons practice behind the curtain is a form of an esoteric practice because it's yeah. restricted to a small group.
Mm-hmm. That's probably the easiest way someone's ever described it to me, actually. Because I was here esoteric and I'm like, forget.
Yeah, it sounds so mystical when it's really yeah. just like
an inside joke, but with
yeah.
heat on it. Yeah.
Yeah. A practice, like a secret handshake between like you and someone is technically esoteric knowledge.
Yeah. So while the age of classical alchemy gave way to the dawn of chemistry, the quest for spiritual transformation and the Philosopher's Stone continued to enchant individuals, giving rise to tales of modern alchemists who sought to unlock the secrets of the universe. And one such figure is Fulcanelli, a name shrouded in mystery, believed to have been active in the early 20th century. And allegedly possessing the knowledge of the Philosopher's Stone, Fulcanelli is said to have mastered the art of prolonging life and transmuting matter, leaving behind cryptid texts such as The Mystery of the Cathedrals, which some nice. Claim...
Thanks. Didn't even try to pronounce that in French.
Nope. Which some claim contain coded instructions for achieving alchemical transmutation. And despite extensive research, Fulcanelli's true identity actually remains a tantalizing enigma, with speculation suggesting that he might have been a composite figure or just an adept passing through the corridors of time, leaving only whispers of wisdom in his wake.
That's the other fun part of all of the alchemy text, is it's all in like riddles. No one was actually saying what they were trying to create knowledge in an esoteric way. And basically saying, if you know, you know, you know, the girls that get it. And the girls that don't is basically how they wrote.
Yeah.
All of the alchemic practices and theories and recipes and yeah. formulas. It was all through basically fucking riddles.
Yeah. And my favorite thing about it too is like the people who figure it out become mysteries and get lost to history, because it's like, oh, they got it fucking figured out now. They're not playing the game you and I play anymore. Mm-hmm. Like they just disappear and they're yeah. living vibrant lives under the radar. Like that's fucking cool.
I think I forget you, it was one of the guys you mentioned, but I'm blanking on his name specifically.
Probably Nicholas Flamel.
Where he wrote all of these texts and people tried to decipher it. And he, when they were like, dude, what the fuck does this mean? He basically said to everyone, if God wants you to know, he'll let you know. But mm-hmm. I'm not here to be your Rosetta Stone. I'm not here to be your translator. If you're supposed to know, you will know. But if not, yeah. good luck. And I'm like, damn, yeah. that would piss me the fuck off.
It would too, because I'd be like, I can change him to tell me.
Yeah, yeah.
So, in the midst of World War II, a tale emerged of a group of alchemists in Britain who, under the leadership of a figure known only as the Master, and this is so fucking cool, endeavored to use alchemical principles to aid the war effort. This is like BPRD, like Hellboy stuff. I love it.
Yeah.
According to legend, they sought to apply the transformative powers of alchemy not to create gold, but to invoke a change in the collective consciousness and ensure peace. And while the concrete evidence of their activities is scant, the story captures the enduring belief in alchemy's potential to bring about profound change.
It's also so crazy that World War II, besides being like the war that everyone's obsessed with, and is one of the most horrific, it is so fucking nerdy when it comes to like magic with a CK.
Yeah.
Because we have both sides participating. We have the Allies trying to perform transmutation through alchemy. And then we also have, obviously, Hitler
mm-hmm.
being obsessed with, like, sigil magic and ritualistic magic. Mm-hmm. And that's unrelated to all the, like, superstitious shit that he was doing and, like, trying to find fucking aliens in the goddamn Hollow Earth and shit. Like, the reason why the Nazis looked the way they did was because he was trying to tap into the same shit that fucking Aleister Crowley was with sigil magic.
Mm-hmm.
And it's yeah, just like, it's- damn, we were all just doing fucking weird shit. That's how you know the war was like crazy town, right? Because like everyone was just throwing everything at the wall and hoping yeah. that something sticked.
I'm actually going to send you a note real quick. The magic of World War II. That would be a great episode. So the 20th century also witnessed the intriguing case of Albert Rydell, also known as Frater Albertus. In 1930, he founded the Paracelsus Research Society, later Paracelsus College, in Salt Lake City, Utah. Hey!
Ooh, hometown hero!
Ooh, where he taught practical alchemy, emphasizing its spiritual aspects. Frater Albertus claimed to have achieved alchemical transmutations and sought to revive the ancient art as a means of personal and universal transformation. His work inspired a new generation of seekers to explore alchemy's mysteries, blending ancient wisdom with modern metaphysical thought. And even in the 21st century, the legend of modern alchemists persists, with individuals and groups around the globe continuing to explore alchemy's principles, whether through the lens of spiritual alchemy, aiming for inner transmutation or transformation. Man, I went Catholic there for a second. Transubstantiation. Or in clandestine laboratories, seeking to replicate the legendary feats of turning lead into gold, these modern magi keep the flame of ancient art alive. And while the likelihood of stumbling upon a true alchemist who has discovered the secrets of eternal life or the Philosopher's Stone remains slim, the legends of modern alchemists remind us of humanity's unending quest for knowledge, transformation, and the eternal. Because in a world dominated by science and technology, these tales invite us to wonder, to dream, and to explore the boundaries between the possible and the impossible.
Woo! Do more magic. I used to perform alchemy by mixing mud and water in the backyard and telling my mom it was cake.
You know what? What the fuck was her name? There was a girl who lived up the road from me, and she was mean to me, and my sister Jessica did the same thing, and she made her eat a plate of mud cake for being mean to me.
Hell yeah, that's tight. Yeah. My mom definitely knew it was mud cake and was like, oh, thank you, and then pretended to eat it and threw it on the ground, but, you know.
Aw.
Transmutation.
I perform alchemy when I drink wine and NyQuil so I can sleep at night.
Yeah, and then one day you won't wake up and you've achieved full metal alchemist.
But I hope so.
Dude, you're knocking on heaven's gate, if you will, every time you fucking do
knocking
that.
Knocking on heaven's door. That song is written about me. So that's so cool. I think it'd be fun to like definitely get into some of these alchemists and like their different pursuits of alchemy rather than just like a broad generalization of what alchemy is. Especially like these dudes and their Enochian text that they wrote.
Yeah, I think like that's like where it veers off, like it forks off in the road. Like finding specific practices of alchemy is tough because everyone fucking spoke in goddamn gibberish, but writings about like Enochian magic and chaos magic and sex magic is very much out there, and there are very specific rituals documented. So,
and if anyone wants to try that, you can read Combined Chaos, which was the hardest fucking book that I never finished.
Yeah, I've got it somewhere. But yeah, that's fun. Fun.
It's so fun.
Speaking of fun, you can find a link in all of our bios. We are at Golden Hell Podcast. I am at Noelle Fain. That is at Sithlard. And in those bios, the link that you will click will take you to things such as our merch, where 100% of proceeds are donated. You can also find our Patreon. A dollar gets you in. You could pay a dollar to hear me cry this week, so that's a bang for your buck.
Right?
And I mean
seeing
that,
it, Flux. Yeah,
come on. Jump, I know you want to hear it. Both fans and haters, just that's a note for you. You can listen to me cry for only a dollar. We also have a link to our Discord server. And of course, to Kelly Holleran or at Wild Wood Owl on Etsy. She makes cool shit for us and she makes cool shit in general. And I don't know why you need it, but there's also links for places to listen to us, which is honestly anywhere podcasts are heard.
Amen.
And I'm going to hail, actually, Eats Bakery in Salt Lake City. Which is one of the best vegan bakeries. She makes the best fucking vegan donuts in the goddamn world. And I hope one day she has a storefront because it hurts my soul to only get a donut once a week on a Saturday morning. I want it. I want to be able to choose my own destiny. I want to be able to make a bad decision on a Tuesday morning. So, hail Eats Bakery.
I'm going to say hail chemistry for making the anti-acne face mask that I bought at TJ Maxx today that I'm going to put on this little pepperoni face and wake up looking a golden goddess.
That's a form of alchemy right there. You're transmutating a pimple into perfect skin.
Yeah, I'm going to bed ugly and waking up only ugly without acne.
There you go. Alchemy.
Perfect.
Okay, let's get the fuck out of here.
All right, bye.
Bye.